Lord Alfred Douglas's father, the Marquess of Queensberry, was a splenetic, atheistic, vengeful brute who intelligently codified the rules of boxing, missed no opportunity to rage against Christianity, cared as little as Oscar did for society's opinion of him, and wrote poetry. Perhaps the poetry surprises you. One of his works begins with the memorable line, "When I am dead, cremate me." Another I recall is, "Go tell mankind, see that thy blood be pure." He believed, you see, that since the soul is not a separate entity from the body, but is an emanation of the body, we must be careful with whom we mate. Because when we propagate, we pass on to our children not only our bodies, but our souls too. Considering certain aspects of the soul of his son, there may be some truth in this. Oscar's first significant encounter with Bosie happened in the spring of 1892. The boy wrote to Oscar to beg for his help. He was being blackmailed. Douglas was beautiful and sensitive and had talent, but he also took a precociously early interest in less sensitive young men, roughs in fact, who for little money and more food and drink would make themselves carnally available. An incriminating letter was being somewhere offered for sale. Oscar quite deftly took control. He had his solicitor friend George Lewis purchase the offered letter. £100, I believe. So the relationship between Bosie and Oscar began under the shadow of blackmail. That shadow followed them for several years, with Bosie's father urging it on.
"Our friendship really begins with your begging me in a most pathetic and charming letter to assist you in a position appalling to anyone, doubly so to a young man at Oxford. I do so. You send me a very nice poem of the undergraduate school of verse. I reply by a letter of fantastic literary conceits, like a passage from one of Shakespeare's sonnets transposed to a minor key. It can only be understood by those who have read the Symposium of Plato. It was, let me say frankly, the sort of letter I would have written to any graceful young man of either university who had sent me a poem of their own making, certain that he would have sufficient wit or culture to interpret rightly its fantastic phrases. Look at the history of that letter. It passes from you into the hands of a loathsome companion, from him to a gang of blackmailers. Copies of it are sent about London, to my friends, to the manager of the theatre where my work is being performed. Every construction but the right one is put on it. This forms the basis of your father's worst attack. I produce the original myself in court to show what it really is. It is denounced by your father's counsel as a revolting and insidious attempt to corrupt innocence. It forms part of the criminal charge. The judge sums up on it with little learning and much morality. I go to prison for it. That is the result of writing you a charming letter. But I need not go on with instances of the strange doom you seem to have brought on me in all things, big or little. Of course, you had your illusions, lived in them, indeed. You thought that your devoting yourself to me, to the entire exclusion of your family, was a proof of your wonderful appreciation of me. You thought that in sending a lawyer's letter to your father to say that rather than sever your eternal friendship with me, you would give up the allowance he was then making you, you were realizing the very chivalry of friendship. But your surrender of your little allowance did not mean that you were ready to give up even one of your most superfluous luxuries. What was merely a pretense of bravado gave you a plausible reason to live at my expense. You thought again that in attacking your own father with dreadful letters, abusive telegrams, and insulting postcards, you were fighting your mother's battles, avenging the no doubt terrible wrongs and sufferings of her married life. It was an illusion, one of your worst. The way for you to have avenged your mother's wrongs was by being a better son to your mother, by not making her afraid to speak to you, by not signing bills the payment of which devolved on her, by being gentler to her and not bringing sorrow into her days. I also had my illusions. I thought life was going to be a brilliant comedy, and that you were to be one of the many graceful figures in it. The Pall Mall Gazette, describing the dress rehearsal of one of my plays, spoke of you as following me about like a shadow. The memory of our friendship is the shadow that walks with me here. It follows me into the prison yard and makes me talk to myself as I tramp around. Each detail, each dreadful moment, I am forced to recall. Every strained note of your voice, every twitch of your nervous hands, every bitter word, every poisonous phrase. There is, I know, one answer to all that I have said. You loved me. Yes, I know you did. No matter what your conduct to me was, I always felt that at heart you really did love me. But you, like myself, have had a terrible tragedy in your life, though one of an entirely opposite character to mine. Do you want to learn what it was? It was this. In you, hate was always stronger than love. Your hatred of your father entirely outstripped and overshadowed your love of me. Love is fed by the imagination, by which we can understand others in their real as in their ideal relations. Only what is fine can feed love. But anything will feed hate. There was not a glass of champagne you drank, not a rich dish you ate, that did not feed your hate and make it fat. To gratify it, you gambled with my life as you gamble with my money, carelessly, recklessly, indifferent to the consequences. When your father first began to attack me, it was in a private letter to you, with obscene threats and coarse violences. I saw at once that a terrible danger was looming on the horizon of my troubled days. You sent a foolish and vulgar telegram as your answer. It was a telegram of which the commonest street boy would have been ashamed. From pert telegrams to priggish lawyer's letters was a natural progress, and the result of your lawyer's letters to your father was, of course, to urge him on still further. You left him no option but to go on. You forced it on him as a point of honour, or of dishonour, rather. So the next time he attacks me in public, he goes from restaurant to restaurant looking for me in order to insult me before the whole world. Then, surely, was the time when you should have come forward and said that you would not expose me to such hideous attacks. But hate blinded you. You scented the chance of a public scandal and flew to it. You hounded him on in the chase still more. Family instincts were strong in him. His hatred of you was just as persistent as your hatred of him, and I was the stalking horse for both of you. He ultimately determines to make his final attack on me as an artist. He secures by fraud a seat for the first night of one of my plays, and contrives a plot to interrupt the performance, to make a foul speech about me to the audience, to throw indecent missiles at me when I am called before the curtain at the close. By the merest chance, in the brief and accidental sincerity of a more than usually intoxicated mood, he boasts of his intention before others. Information is given to the police, and he is kept out of the theatre. You had your chance then. Don't you realize now that you should have come forward and said that you would not have my art, at any rate, ruined for your sake? You knew what my art was to me, the real passion of my life, the love to which all other loves were as marsh water to red wine. But hate blinded you. You thought simply of how to get your father into prison, to see him in the dock, as you used to say. Well, you had your desire gratified. For 2 days you sat on a high seat with the sheriffs and feasted your eyes with the spectacle of your father standing in the dock of the Central Criminal Court. And on the third day, I took his place. What had occurred? In your hideous game of hate together, you had both thrown dice for my soul, and you happened to have lost. That was all. You see that I have to write your life to you, and you have to realize it. The supreme vice is shallowness. Whatever is realized is right. I have now got as far as the house of detention, have I not? After a night passed in the police cells, I am sent there in a van. You were most attentive and kind. Almost every afternoon, till you go abroad, you took the trouble to drive up to Holloway to see me. You also wrote very sweet and nice letters, but that it was not your father but you who had put me into prison never for one instant dawned on you. You had the sympathy and the sentimentality of the spectator of a rather pathetic play. That you were the true author of the hideous tragedy did not occur to you. I remember your producing with absolute pride a letter you had published in one of the halfpenny papers about me. It was a very commonplace production. You appealed to the English sense of fair play, or something dreary of that kind, on behalf of a man who was down. But you thought it a wonderful letter, proof of almost quixotic chivalry. I am aware that you wrote other letters to newspapers that they did not publish, but then they were simply to say that you hated your father. Nobody cared if you did or not. To write to the papers to say that one hates someone else is as if one were to write to the papers to say that one had a shameful malady. The fact that the man you hated was your own father, and that the feeling was thoroughly reciprocated, did not make your hate noble in any way. If it showed anything, it was simply that it was a hereditary disease. Hate blinds people. Do you see it now? How clearly I saw it then, as now. But I said to myself, at all costs I must keep love in my heart. If I go into prison without love, what will become of my soul? When the prison dress was on me and the prison house closed, I sat bewildered with terror, dazed through pain. But I would not hate you. Every day I said to myself, I must keep love in my heart today. Else how shall I live through the day? It did not occur to me that you could have the supreme vice, shallowness. The day the solicitor's clerk came to receive my depositions and statements, he leant across the table, the prison warder being present, and said to me in a low voice, Prince Fleur-de-Lis wishes to be remembered to you. I did not know what he meant. The gentleman is abroad at present, he added mysteriously. For the first and last time in my entire prison life, I laughed. In that laugh was all the scorn of all the world. Prince Fleur-de-Lis, you were in your own eyes still the graceful prince of a trivial comedy. Your seemingly casual choice of a feigned name was, and will remain, symbolic. It reveals you.